Hello, America. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Along with me is our special commentator and my dear friend, Jeffrey Hedquist.
Yes, I am here.
Thank you, Jeffrey. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends. We are calling from the heart of America, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. We have a very special guest today, Dr. Art Cardin. He is a professor of economics and business at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and an adjunct fellow at the Oakland, California-based Independent Institute. He obtained his PhD at Washington University in St. Louis and is a massive Cardinals fan.
I am, yes.
Okay. So welcome to our show today, Art. I really appreciate you coming. One of the things that we want to talk with you about is one of the many essays that you have created, and the one that we're going to start with is called The Myths of Capitalism's History. And I found this to be very interesting because one of the key points you brought out in this was that regular people throughout the 18th century and even before could expect to see no economic progress in their lifetimes. Tell us about that, Art.
So I'll begin by making a couple of reading suggestions. The article to which you refer is based on reading Friedrich Hayek's book Capitalism and the Historians, which he and a handful of others wrote in the 1950s. And I would also encourage people to take a look at Deirdre McCluskey's series of books on the bourgeois era. Now, this claim about there not being any economic progress for most of history, if you look at the data, and economic historians have done a fantastic job assembling long-range data sets, per capita income, which is generally our measure of prosperity, has remained flat for almost all of history.
So people didn't make any more money.
Right.
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 What about conveniences?
Conveniences were relatively limited.
So inventions were relatively limited.
Right.
Okay, so that kind of economic progress didn't happen either.
Most truly meaningful economic progress has occurred in the last couple of centuries. Mm-hmm. So I remember an analogy, I forget where I read this, but it said basically if you took Aristotle and took him to Thomas Aquinas' office during the Middle Ages, everything would be more or less the same. You know, Aristotle would sit with Aquinas and they perhaps might debate. Mm-hmm. If you take Aristotle and put him in the office of one of the early classical economists in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, then, yeah, there's some serious changes. But still, there's going to be an awful lot that's familiar to Aristotle in that world. Now, if you take Aristotle...
Like no air conditioning.
Right. No air conditioning. No refrigeration.
Yeah, like that.
Everyone dies of tuberculosis.
Outdoor plumbing.
Outdoor plumbing.
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, if you take Aristotle and plop him down today in a modern office at a modern college or university, or if you take him to the Mises Institute or something like that, it would absolutely blow his mind.
Would he have as much trouble with his iPod as I do?
My guess would be that Aristotle probably would have as much trouble with his iPod.
I'm constantly asking my 14-year-old to help me with it. Yeah.
Right. I wonder about that sometimes. I say my grandparents never had to worry about making iPod playlists or updating their Facebook pages and things like that. So it's clearly an inferior world.
Well, even the concept of books is something that Aristotle really didn't have because they didn't have really book binding and such.
Right. The intellectual world in which we live today is truly amazing. And one thing I mentioned in a lecture that I gave here a few minutes ago is if you just look at paper, paper and ink, the ability to engage the world in an intellectual way is radically different from what it was many, many moons ago. Mm-hmm. So not just the fact that today we have blogs and the internet and all of these wonderful innovations, but just something as simple and mundane as the ability to write your thoughts on paper, something that we all take
for granted. Or be able to read them.
Or to be able to read them. These are things that we all take for granted that from our ancestors for most of our history never really had.
So that's great. I really appreciate this opener here. So we're going to be back after a short break, and we're going to be talking to Art Cardin more about the myths of capitalism's history. And so this is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay. So I would ask everyone to come back after the break.
And
see you soon.
Aristotle, look forward to the air conditioning.
And that would be the sign off. Okay? All right. So now we're Radio Free Market. I am speaking with Dr. Art Cardin. And from Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, we're talking about myths of capitalism's history. We were just talking about the lack of progress that had occurred throughout the history of humanity, which suddenly exploded about 200-300 years ago. Can you talk more about that, Art?
So we have this almost historical discontinuity beginning sometime between 1500 and 1750, give or take a couple of decades, during which living standards for the average person start to increase dramatically. So if we consider life expectancy at the height of the Roman Empire, it was 24.
Mm-hmm.
If we consider life expectancy during the Industrial Revolution, it got as high as maybe 40.
Okay, let's just talk about that little segment there. What caused or what would be some of the examples of how their living standards were improved? Were they bathing more or less, or what was happening there?
Bathing and basic hygiene would definitely contribute a lot to it. Mm-hmm. Basic medicine, nutrition was a major contributor mm-hmm. to changes in standards of living over time. Mm-hmm. So today we're actually one can say that we're almost we're overfed.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, today in the United States and Europe, we're having debates about obesity.
Right.
Whereas historically, people were having, well, first of all, they didn't have the luxury of having debates because they had to do everything they could to avoid starvation.
Right.
Medical technology mm-hmm. has changed a lot. And just the general ability to purchase goods and services mm-hmm. has allowed people opportunities that they didn't have previously.
So between the Roman Empire and around the 1500s, there was some modest improvement in the standard of living. But it exploded around the 1700s, 1800s.
Right.
So let's go back to that.
Why that happened is still sort of an open issue. The naive historical story was that James Watt unveiled his steam engine, and the next morning it was the Industrial Revolution. Well,
uh-huh.
that's not
I think I read that in high school.
Right. Or Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, and the next mm-hmm. morning, so history is at times a story of great men who fight great wars, and when they're not fighting great wars, they're inventing great things. And that I find that dissatisfying as a story of history. Recently, people have argued that what created modern economic growth was large constraints on the state,
mm-hmm.
big constraints on the state's ability to expropriate and redistribute resources, so that the way to get rich was to invent things and to produce things that people actually wanted to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas previously, the best way to get rich was to purchase some type of royal position.
Yeah,
it allowed you to tax.
So basically, before, if you wanted to be rich, you basically either had to marry, kill, or buy your way into a position of privilege.
Right, and that's a very good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
A complementary thing that happened, and this is Deirdre McCluskey's explanation, is a change in sort of the social rhetoric, where it became somehow dignified for people to be bourgeois. Indeed, that's her
bourgeois.
Her
how do we translate bourgeois into the east side of Detroit?
Okay. How do we translate bourgeois? Basically, middle class, middle managers, people who just go to work every day.
So normal folk.
Right. Normal people.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That there was a certain being a merchant, buying low and selling high, acquired a dignity that it didn't have previously. So the fact that this came to be viewed as morally acceptable laid the foundations for industrialization and for the economic growth that we've seen over the last couple of centuries.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this. There were a number of myths that started to come out as a result
right.
of this. And this was actually the headline for this show. One that I saw that you had read was that the rich did not get richer.
Right. Yeah, so the rich...
That's so counterintuitive.
Right. Yeah, the rich have always been rich, and this is one of the, again, myths of the history of capitalism is that the rich got richer at the expense of the poor.
Okay.
And here I'm going to rely on research done by Gregory Clark, an economic historian who's studied these issues. And if you look at the predictions of classical economics
mm-hmm.
and the predictions of the common understanding, and then also the predictions of Marxian economics as it arose in the 19th century, payments or income would accrue to owners of land,
mm-hmm.
to owners of capital, and to laborers.
Mm-hmm.
The prediction was that all of the income would be absorbed by capital and land, and workers' wages would tend towards subsistence. The fact is that this was exactly precisely the opposite of what actually happened. Rents on land and interest rates on capital have stayed constant for centuries, roughly, with some fluctuations. Wages for laborers, particularly for unskilled laborers, exploded as a result of industrialization.
When did that really get started?
When did that really get started? Again, give or take a couple of decades, the date that I usually see is 1700, 1750 is when,
okay. So
when things really started to change.
Prior to that time, people are basically living hand-to-mouth. It's subsistence.
Right.
You know, the entire purpose of your life is to get through to the next day.
Exactly.
And now, all of a sudden, wages are starting to get up and people have some discretionary income.
Right.
Suddenly, there's a situation where the people who were essentially the serfs and oppressed of the past become something called consumers.
Right.
And that's when everything changes.
Right. These are major, major changes that happen, because if you look at a world of subsistence in which maternal mortality is astronomical, infant mortality is astronomical, the probability of being killed in violent conflict is very high relative to today. People don't really have an incentive to invest. Well, one, they don't have any income, and two, they don't have any incentive to invest in developing the kinds of moral qualities that we associate with virtue today.
Mm-hmm.
I'll paraphrase McCluskey. She says that a mass of impoverished juveniles makes for easy tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know that everybody you know is going to be dead of tuberculosis by age 40, if they make it long enough, you know, if they don't die in infancy, then what incentive do you have to become literate?
Mm-hmm.
What incentive do you have to want to read the great works of world civilization? What incentive do you have to develop ideas?
Mm-hmm.
What incentive do you have anything to do besides drink, fight, reproduce,
mm-hmm.
and try to make sure that you scrape together enough calories to make it to the next day?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Art, was this true just in Western civilization, European Western, or what about Asian history and the continents that we often refer to as third world and yet often refer to again as the cradle of civilization? How is the mortality and capital distribution in those areas?
I'm most familiar, as a Westerner, I'm most familiar with the Western experience.
Sure.
This is one of the great historical questions is why Europe and not China, or why Europe and not the Middle East? Because if you go back 1,000 years, Europe was this horrific backwater, and the great civilizations were in the Orient and in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. And this I believe is still an open issue.
I know that there was a lecture I heard by Stephen White out of Oxford or Cambridge, excuse me, that said that that once the Chinese sunk their navy around 400 or 500 years ago and basically mm-hmm. became isolationists, they basically stratified themselves.
Right.
They couldn't get any further.
Mm-hmm.
If they hadn't done that, just because of the free exchange that they would have automatically had,
right.
They, you know, everything in today's world would have a Chinese flavor, and still yet might.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, like I said, these are some of the great unanswered questions of history, is why has the last 500 years been, I guess, sort of the European era, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Islamic era or the Chinese era?
Because, you know, from 325 for about 1,000 years,
right.
The center of civilization on the earth was basically the Byzantine Empire.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, so.
Right, so to put it in terms that I've seen, you had in the Islamic world, you had in the Chinese world, people who were making serious advances in technology and culture and literature and all sorts of other wonderful things when, you know, our multi-great European ancestors were, suffice it to say, not
slogging
doing the same things. Sorry?
Slogging it out. For
right, exactly, exactly.
Right, yeah, just trying to make do.
So the transition is a little bit fuzzy, and I think there are cultural elements that explain part of it. I'm hesitant to offer my own deep hypothesis, but one thing we do know is that in the 20th century, and in the early 21st century as India, well, India and China particularly, as they've adopted free market reforms, mm-hmm. and as they've moved toward the development of a market economy, then we're seeing a flowering of, one, productivity in China and India with high growth rates. Second, a flowering of culture. And again, here I'll borrow from McCluskey. She thinks that the 21st century is going to be the African century.
Hmm. Interesting.
Because she argues that there's more, and I'm trying to go from memory here. She argues that there's more genetic variation among Africans in Africa than there is among, say, people of European extraction. So the cultural potential of Africa is astronomical. Mm-hmm. So if we think that Europe did well in the last couple of centuries, if Africa is able to straighten itself out institutionally, mm-hmm. then the African experience over the next century could be, you know, unlike anything that the world has ever seen.
Now, you know, we're getting a little off track here, but this mm-hmm. is okay because this is kind of fun.
Right. Yeah.
You brought up something here I'd like to ask you about, the role of property rights.
Yes.
You know, now,
yes.
One of the things that's often said about Russia.
Right.
One of the things I'd like to say is I'd like to carry that discussion of property rights into our next segment because we're just about wrapping up this one.
Okay. Well,
but there will be a short break of about 3 minutes, and then we invite you back to see where this tangent goes.
Very good.
Free Market
after the break.
Radio. You're listening to Free Market Radio. My name is Jeffrey Hedquist, a close friend of Michael McKay, and our guest today is Art Carden from Rhodes College. And let's pick up the thread that we were just talking about, Art, if you would.
Certainly. So I mentioned in the last segment a point about variation in Africa that provides all sorts of potential, and I wanted to clarify that because it sounds dangerously close and uncomfortably close, in my opinion, to being a eugenic argument. Because when we talk about variations in culture, when we talk about variations in genetics, more variety is good because it can produce far greater growth. So there's more. So the fact that there's so much variety in Africa means that there's so much potential.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa,
from
and
that
if,
particular perspective,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yes, mm-hmm. yeah. So the degree to which we can get the institutions that would allow us to exploit and harness that variability.
Well, basically, you know, when you use the word exploit, I think what you're really talking about is that you're setting up automatic groups that because people are basically tribal,
right?
And you know, if there are basic institutions of respective property rights.
Right.
Across a broader range of people who
right.
are basically different, that sets up, you know, additional new
right.
trading groups to work with.
Yeah, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
Like that. And but you know, as an essential feature of being able to actually make progress economically, what we're really talking about here is property rights.
Right.
You know, and property rights really are the essential thing that we really have to be focusing on here.
Right. Yeah, so the rules and norms of a free society, secure private property rights, study after study after study after study, shows that secure private property rights and economic freedom lead to increases in economic development.
Mm-hmm.
So among the tragedies of history are the fact that so many places have remained poor
mm-hmm.
while relatively few places have gotten it right. So
mm-hmm.
to speak, have developed the institutions that lead to large-scale economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing that transition in China and India as they develop free market institutions. We saw that transition in South Korea, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Taiwan
mm-hmm.
in the late 20th century. And we saw how much progress could be made in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, rule of law, low right. taxation.
Absolutely.
You know, you create a hotbed for opportunity.
Right.
You know, because when people have solid property rights, they can do something called economic calculation.
Yes, absolutely.
And longer-term economic calculation, you know, generates the opportunity for greater growth.
Right. Absolutely. Yes, long-term economic calculation leads to economic growth. When people have private property rights, mm-hmm. they can engage in these kinds of activities that ultimately lead to prosperity for all.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about optimism for the developing world, it's not necessarily a problem that poor people are poor. They're not poor because they're poor. They're poor because the rules are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're able to – so if they're able to develop rules that allow them to that allow individuals to flourish, then like McCloskey said, the 21st century could be the African century.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of thinkers right now are talking about how the next 50 years everything's going to be really dominated by China economically. And so, of course, we're going to see. But let's go back in history a little bit.
Certainly.
And let's talk about the other myths of capitalism's history. One that you mentioned in this essay of yours was that there was a period of pristine childhood you were debunking the idea that there was a pristine childhood and that children were robbed of their innocence by wicked industrial masters.
Right. For almost all of history, there really hasn't been such a thing as childhood. Mm-hmm. And when we think of childhood, when I think of my own childhood, I have this kind of idyllic time when I didn't really have any responsibilities. But almost as soon as you were old enough to work, you were working
mm-hmm.
for most of history. You were either working...
And actually, I want to interrupt you here because this was another one of your points, that labor did not confront people as being something alien.
Right.
You know, this is something you were born to do. You know, you could walk, you could carry something.
Right. Yeah, the...
And even in today's rural areas, you know, farm families work together from
certainly,
the time
certainly.
They're old enough to, you know, take responsibility. That's part of the ethics. That's part of the economy of small farms.
Right. Yeah, people think of child labor as this horrible thing that happened during industrialization. But like you both mentioned, everybody has worked
mm-hmm.
always.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition from the farm to the factory increased family incomes as a result of the fact, in part because...
It decreased the amount of work time that
right.
it took to create that income.
Right. Yeah, it increased incomes. It reduced the amount of work that was available. And in most cases... The children who were working during early industrialization, the reason anybody does anything is because their next best alternative is necessarily worse.
Mm-hmm.
So children who were working during early industrialization were doing it because if they didn't, they died.
Uh-huh.
Or everybody died.
Uh-huh.
Or they had to in some way contribute to the family income.
Right.
We see this today in the movement against sweatshops.
Uh-huh.
So we look today and say, well, we'll look at these sweatshop laborers. They're working under these horrible conditions. They're working horrible hours and so on and so forth. Isn't this bad? Well, by Western standards, these are jobs that none of us would take.
Right.
However, when you're on the brink of starvation,
mm-hmm.
a job like this could be your ticket out.
Right.
A job like this could be your step. This could be your next step up the economic ladder. And furthermore,
now, our ticket out
yeah.
to the next segment will only take 3 minutes. A wonderful
certainly.
3 minutes to hear from great sponsors, and then we will be back with Free Market Radio.
And we're back. This is Michael McKay, RadioFreeMarket.com, and with me today is Art Carden, and of course our irrepressible Jeffrey Hedquist.
That's
and
right. Able to be repressed.
I try to repress you, but
I know.
That's not possible. And so, Art, please continue where you were.
So we're talking about the sweatshop movement.
Mm-hmm.
And by Western standards, a lot of times we look at quote-unquote third-world sweatshops and say, this is some injustice that's being done to the people. And here I'll borrow an idea that I first heard from David Henderson. He said, someone who works hard to get you fired is not your friend.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that people take jobs in what we think of as sweatshops is because their next best alternative is necessarily inferior.
Mm-hmm.
When, I believe in 1998, when the International Soccer Federation said that they weren't going to use sweatshop-made soccer balls, this was taken as a wonderful
mm-hmm.
gesture of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But people who work in sweatshops, when the sweatshop closes, they're kicked out into the street or they're kicked out into inferior lines of work,
right.
such as...
And more dangerous to it.
Far more dangerous.
Yes.
Picking through garbage piles,
right.
for example. Child prostitution.
Right.
Starvation.
Mm-hmm.
So on and so forth. So the relevant comparison is not how does working, sewing soccer balls or sewing garments compare to being an executive in the United States or working at McDonald's in the United States? But is this better or worse than the relevant alternative? Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I think most children will choose sweatshop labor to something as degrading as child prostitution.
Of course. And, of course, we would love to see, interesting thing is that all of us who grew up here in the West, we all have, some memories, positive, maybe negative also, of our childhoods. But it's an interesting phenomenon that as our time of labor was shrunk, where we didn't have to work 80 hours and 90 hours a week just to survive, all of us, maybe the number one recipient of the reward of leisure were children.
Oh, certainly.
And so they actually got to have a whole different category of life structured for them around that concept. And we have grown up these last few or several generations assuming that that's the way it always was.
Right.
And, it's quite an interesting thing to go back and think about that it really wasn't that way.
Oh, certainly.
Well, there's I would like to close this particular topic with one comment that you made that really struck me in your essay on the myths of capitalism's history, which, by the way, folks, is available at Mises.org. And if you want to go to Mises.org, that's Mises.org. You've heard me recommend that many, many times, and that is a wonderful website. It has a lot of excellent free resources where you can actually educate yourself, not only in general economics, but on the bailout. There's this whole section there called the Bailout Reader that I'll talk about a little bit more in a little while. This particular story is number 3455. The story is called The Myths of Capitalism's History by Dr. Art Carden. And I'm going to close with this on this segment or this section on this one quote that you said, that nothing guarantees economic growth forever. And this is one of the things that we as Americans in particular assume, that our children are going to have a higher quality of life and that their children are going to have a higher quality of life and so on and so forth. But there's nothing inherently guaranteeing us to have a higher quality of life. Talk about the things that are actually standing in the road here in front of us that could actually take away our quality of life, that are threatening us right now.
I'm generally very optimistic about the long run, because in spite of short run variations, as long as we maintain the political, economic, and social institutions that we have, then we can't expect long run growth. But given that almost all of human history is characterized by extreme poverty, this suggests that we can get it wrong just as easily as we can get it right. As one of my former mentors, or well, not really a former mentor, but as one of my mentors has told me. And the institutions of private property rights are essential, like you've said, for economic calculation. They're essential for long-run economic growth. Mm-hmm. Economic freedom is a necessary condition for long-run prosperity, and the absence of economic freedom is one of the reasons why, unfortunately, so many countries and so many places are relatively poor.
So encroaching restrictions on economic freedom, should we be all that worried about them, or should we think that they're kind of a temporary phenomenon that are, I know you're an optimist. I know you're a Cardinals fan, so we have to take that into consideration.
Yeah. So should we be optimistic, or should we worry about some of these things? Well, I'd like to think, and we bring this into high relief when we talk about issues like healthcare or immigration, mm-hmm. for example. So, Lant Pritchett, an economist at Harvard, has an excellent new book. It's called "Let Their People Come," and it talks about the expected returns from opening the borders,
mm-hmm.
we'll say. And unfortunately, among the causes of human misery are, like we said, insecure private property rights and things like that, but then also restricted access to markets. So this takes the form of regulations within rich countries,
mm-hmm.
whereby, say, for example, you're not allowed to give manicures without a license
right.
in New Hampshire.
Or interior decorate in Iowa.
Right, yeah. Or be an interior decorator in Iowa.
Or a flower arranger in Louisiana.
Right, yeah, or be a flower arranger in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And while none of these things is by itself devastating to commercial society, it's a death by a thousand cuts approach that's backed by assumptions about what the state can legitimately do
mm-hmm.
that I personally don't really share.
Yeah, so what we basically are looking at is a state that must, you know, give us permissions
right.
to do whatever we want to do.
Right.
And, you know, actually this is not something that we talked about before, but I'm wondering if you know this. I read somewhere that there was maybe 34 years ago only about 35 different kinds of licensings, and there's now several hundred
right.
different kind of licensing
yeah.
that people have to or may have to get in order to
right.
engage in different work.
Yeah, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but
yeah.
there but it's actually changing the way that labor economics is being taught
mm-hmm.
because labor economics textbooks, for example, they'll talk about wage restrictions,
mm-hmm.
but major interventions in labor markets have been mostly regulatory
mm-hmm.
over the last several centuries.
Okay.
Or excuse me, not centuries. The last several decades.
Yeah. So now what I wanted to do is talk about this other essay that you wrote on why Walmart matters, and we want to start
right.
off by talking about the untold or largely untold story that you know about how back at Hurricane Katrina,
right.
how Walmart was a first responder, and how did that work out for them?
Well, first of all, it was very good for the company in
mm-hmm.
terms of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
This is.
Well, tell us what they, because I don't think many people even know that
oh, right,
story.
Right. Okay. So the response of firms like Walmart and organizations like the Red Cross to Hurricane Katrina was very, very interesting, because so Walmart actually has its own disaster operations center.
Mm-hmm.
They invest very heavily in weather forecasting technology, and they move product in such a way as to try to stay ahead of the storm,
mm-hmm.
So to speak. So this is a profit maximizing consideration for them, and then also, to the degree that humanitarian efforts can work as advertising, they gave a lot of discretion to their people on the ground, excuse me, to react to conditions in ways that they thought would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So Walmart and the Red Cross were, if anything, they were the real first responders to Hurricane Katrina. And if anything, FEMA got in the way.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So, and how did FEMA get in the way?
Well, partially through just gross incompetence,
uh-huh.
not really knowing what they were doing. Also, actually actively preventing firms like Walmart, Home Depot, and organizations like the Red Cross
from delivering water
right,
and things like
right,
that.
Yeah, from delivering aid.
Yeah, because I remember they actually told them to turn their trucks around and send them
right.
the other way.
Right, right.
And that certainly didn't help anybody. And all right, so one of the things you write about in about Walmart is that Walmart matters, you know, for anyone who cares about the alleviation of poverty.
Right.
And you even quote a New York Times columnist, John Tierney,
mm-hmm.
who said that Walmart's impact on global poverty has been much larger. And then he was actually comparing it to someone who had just won the Nobel Prize and their focus on the alleviation of poverty. But that I found very, very interesting.
Right. So there are a lot of good reasons to criticize Walmart, certainly. Let's hear a couple of them. Okay. Well, in the last couple of years, they advocated a higher minimum wage
mm-hmm.
in 2005,
mm-hmm.
which sounds wonderful and enlightened, but Walmart pays higher than minimum wages.
Mm-hmm.
So what they gain from a higher minimum wage is that the minimum wage can cripple some of their competitors.
Ah.
So when I talk about reasons to be skeptical of some of my earlier optimism, changes in the returns to political activity as opposed to economic activity
mm-hmm.
for firms like Walmart dampened some of my enthusiasm about the very long run.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, Walmart has signed on supporting employer-mandated health care, which, again, people are saying Walmart has apparently seen the progressive light. But, again, I'm skeptical, to say the least, because what Walmart is going to get out of this, in part, is going to be a place at the political table when policy is made. And then second, regulatory burdens on their competitors. Again, so Walmart...
So there are some legitimate criticisms
Of
Walmart.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's talk about the low prices.
Right.
And how low prices help alleviate poverty.
Yeah, so let's... Okay,
how do these compare...
We'll talk about low prices.
Yeah, and let's talk about how this helps the poor in relationship to, for example, U.S. food stamps.
Okay. So we... Well, I don't really know the... I don't remember off the top of my head the relationship with food stamps. A co-author and I have recently estimated that Walmart saves the average family for about $500 a year, okay, which is about 20% of the Walmart-funded estimate that came out several years ago. But still, $500 is a lot. And one thing that we've noticed in some of the studies that we've done is that actually Walmart increased exposure to Walmart, Sam's Club, Costco, sort of large-scale firms like this, is associated with lower, trivially lower, but nonetheless lower rates of obesity because people they have more income and are therefore able to eat better food for the most part. So the debate about Walmart, I think, is not a debate about one company as such, as much as it's a debate about which institutions are desirable for a society that wishes to prosper. And so Walmart is sort of like the poster company for unfettered, unabashed capitalism.
I'd like to actually jump in here and ask you, well, what about the criticism that Walmart actually damages or even destroys small towns?
So Walmart comes in and destroys a community. In a paper that was actually published in Public Choice earlier this year, some co-authors and I look at the data, and we take some data on Walmart, and we take data that Robert Putnam used to write his 2000 book Bowling Alone, and we find that there's no systematic effect of Walmart on kind of non-income, non-monetary measures of quality of life. So the frequency with which you have dinner with your friends, or the frequency with which you play team sports and things like this, all of this stuff that doesn't show up in income measures, Walmart just doesn't really appear to matter. Walmart does matter for employment, which it increases. Walmart does matter for real incomes, which it also increases.
In small communities.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but all of the idea that so Walmart destroys communities, this view, I think, is a little bit overhyped. And the data that we have don't support it.
Where I see the criticism is that small businesses, those clustered around the square in downtown areas, or even in suburban areas, are being impacted because Walmart can essentially sell these things for lower prices than they can buy them.
Right. So the criticism of Walmart destroying small businesses, that's also come under attack. There was a study in the journal Economic Inquiry suggesting that Walmart also doesn't affect small business employment. So the convenient story that Walmart destroys small businesses, again, doesn't really appear to be supported by the data. Now, there's some controversy about the quality of those data. But the argument there is that, yes, so Walmart comes in, and mom-and-pop's hardware store and mom-and-pop's grocery and mom-and-pop's clothing store, they'll close because they can't compete with Walmart on price. They can't compete with Walmart on selection. Now, what will happen, though, is that people will use that increment to income that they get from Walmart's prices, and they'll either invest it or spend it. They'll invest it in or spend it on other things. So something comes into the void to take the place of mom-and-pop's small grocery and mom-and-pop's hardware store and things like that.
So maybe the hardware store will turn itself into a framing store.
Right, yeah.
Or something of that nature.
Right.
Like that.
Certainly.
Yeah, in fact, actually, we've seen exactly that kind of a process occur in our small community.
The challenge as part of that is with that discretionary income, instead of going to a local merchant, will then go to an international merchant on the web. The savings that people have and the small businesses that go out of business are finding that those purchases are now being, you know, outsourced as opposed to bringing money into the community.
Right.
Well, that's good. Now let's go to the next topic, because I pulled this title off of one of your papers here, Art, and I unfortunately didn't have time to read it, but it was so interesting. I thought, okay, there's a story behind here. The title of this paper was The Magnificence of Disposable Diapers. And so,
right.
So please tell us your story on that.
Okay. So I have a deep and abiding interest in environmental issues. I care a lot about environmental issues because I care about people. And so it's a little bit non-traditional in terms of how I relate to people who would describe themselves as like capital E environmentalists. But disposable diapers get a bad rap, I think. And we had our son turns 1 year old tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations!
So, thank you. Yeah. So fatherhood has taught me a lot about environmental economics
and disposable diapers.
And
Hope he's got a job in a sweatshop. That's all.
Yeah.
But one thing that I find interesting is a criticism of disposable diapers is that, and this speaks to broader environmental issues more generally. One criticism is, well, they have to be thrown away and they fill up landfills and they use all of these resources for production and things like this. But one thing, among the things that disposable diapers do is they substitute for cloth diapers that you no longer have to wash with harsh chemicals and things like that that end up in the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
And further, and this is going to sound odd, by throwing away disposable diapers, it may be conceivable that we're creating a future fuel supply. Hmm. So my friend Mike Munger, who's a fellow WashU PhD actually, and is chairman of the political science department at Duke, has a hypothesis that someday we'll be strip mining old landfills in order to extract petroleum products.
So we're going to be digging for
right.
this, and
right.
we won't use that particular
right.
word. We're going to break right now. We're
Certainly.
Going to come back with our Cardinus Radio Free Market.
Okay, this is Free Market Radio. We're here with Art Cardin as our guest. I'm Jeffrey Hedquist, and, of course, we have the chief questioner, and that is
Poobah.
Michael McKay. Yeah, Poobah
yes.
is the
Yes,
the
thank
correct
you
name.
Very much, Jeffrey.
And Art has just given us the provocative thing about strip mining landfills for
well,
future...
Well, strip mining landfills for disposable diapers, there's quite an interesting number of...
I think there's
Thoughts
a song
like
in there, and I'm going to work it.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because it's an interesting possibility, and it gives hope for what we just see as an endless supply of something that will never, ever biodegrade in anyone's lifetime.
Right. Well, again, this is something that, like I said, has become very vivid for me as a father who spends an awful lot of time changing
or just an awful time.
But, yeah, an awful time, right. So I was wondering what one evening, should I feel bad about using disposable diapers? And I came to the conclusion that the answer to that is no, because it saves my time, it saves my energy, it's cheap, it doesn't result in us dumping harsh chemicals into the water supply. And then, like I said, people criticize resource use and non-biodegradable stuff because either it's just going to sit around, there's this view that the resources will never be useful again. But the fact of the matter is that the stuff doesn't just go away when you use it, and we have landfills filled with all sorts of stuff: empty milk jugs, mm-hmm. disposable diapers, and diapers are just kind of the stand-in that I use when I think about this argument. The resources themselves, they're transformed. They don't go away. And at some point, we might be able to find some way to reuse them, to generate fuel, to reuse them to generate something, anything. I'm not a physicist or a chemist or a biologist mm-hmm. or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But
maybe somebody's already doing this.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, now, this
yeah.
is not a call-in show this week, folks. Next week, we will have a call-in show that we're planning. And so if somebody
but
knows about of someone that is actually working on such a project, we'd love to hear about that. And
don't hesitate to email Michael himself.
Yeah, I'd love to get emails about disposable diapers. Yeah,
I would too. And perhaps a folk music culture will develop within the next century or two around diaper mining. But
well, I think you bring up a bigger point, and unfortunately, we only have like 2 minutes left on this segment and the show. But you bring up an important point about the positive potential consequences of these resources that we potentially could recycle in the future.
Right. Well, this is so to begin. I pollution is a problem not because of production, but because governments generally are the ones who collect garbage and run landfills. So the price of throwing stuff away is too low.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I probably don't have time to get into too much detail
right,
on.
Right, we don't.
Right. But I'll encourage the listeners to read Julian Simon's book, The Ultimate Resource, too. Because as stuff gets expensive, we search for substitutes.
Okay, Julian Simon's.
The Ultimate Resource.
The Ultimate Resource.
Right. Okay. As stuff gets expensive, we search for substitutes. We search for newer, better ways to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's conceivable that given that disposable diapers use a lot of petroleum,
mm-hmm.
That at some point when we're searching for newer energy supplies, someone might find a way to convert old diapers, old milk jugs, old plastic bags
mm-hmm.
into a potential energy source.
Or maybe make diapers out of shredded carrots.
Make diapers out of something else.
Out of something
else. So mm-hmm. is it disgusting? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I hope that my son doesn't end up being a diaper miner.
So,
but
what were you saying, Jeffrey?
It's actually quite hopeful, though. At the
oh,
other
certainly,
end.
Certainly, yeah.
And so your son may very well be a diaper miner magnet.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mentioned earlier human potential, and I'll close with my optimism. The human mind is unlimited in its potential, and this is perhaps an entertaining, if disgusting, example.
Yeah. Well, an excellent interview. Thank you very much for your time, Art.
Thank you.
This is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist, RadioFreeMarket.com. Please see us on the web, RadioFreeMarket.com.